The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, Kevin Byrne is with me now. He's a retired Lieutenant Colonel and airport safety and security expert, and he wants to talk to us about weather, prompted by his own experience recently. Kevin, what happened
to you? Good
morning,
Pat. I was on a long-haul flight in a small little airplane, an A321 long range, which I hadn't been on before, from a place called Almaty in Kazakhstan, 9 hours to Heathrow Airport. And we were flying over the central part of Afghanistan, as you do, at 35,000 feet, when we were hit seriously by a thing called clear air turbulence, which we have discussed in the past. And my wine spilled, Pat, so I was just contemplating.
Oh, for shame.
Yeah, it was
for
a terrible shame. I had to get more wine, not in business class, I hasten to add. But it reminded me that the winter's coming in and that weather has a huge effect on the aircraft and operations.
Okay, we'll talk about the different elements of the weather.
Yes.
But clear air turbulence is something that the pilot's radar cannot see.
No, and that's the whole thing. It lasted about 4.5 minutes over what looked like the desert of Kazakhstan like that. Clear day, beautiful sunny weather, cool enough like that, but presumably some updrafts and downdrafts hit us. But at 35,000 feet, you don't expect to hit it. It shuttered the aircraft. We pitched left and right, up and down. And of course, they had to stop serving the food and strap everybody in for about 4 minutes.
And what was the reaction of your fellow travellers?
There were some gasps and things, but I said, look, it's only clear air turbulence. We'll be through it in 4 or 5 minutes. And we were. And it wasn't a big deal. But then again, the flight was caught by the end of the storm that had covered UK and Ireland as we got to Heathrow Airport. We had to go into a holding pattern over the city of London, a fine place at 12,000 feet. Relatively calm, but I saw the blooming the eye three times. The final approach to runway 28 in Heathrow, though, was staggering because it was fighting down below 5,000 feet. We were pitching, yawing and rolling all at the same time. So crosswinds and heavy turbulence were very severe. And I said to my fellow passenger, we're going to go around at 300 feet. But we didn't. In fairness to the pilots, they
got it down.
Super job.
Or
but it was as close as I've ever seen. It was bouncing from side to side. And even on the runway, we pitched sideways towards the grass and straightened.
You know the way that you sometimes see these dramatic shots during a storm of a plane tacking in like
a
yacht.
That's exactly what we were doing, Pat. And I said, we're going to go around to 300 feet, but the skill was such that we got in and landed. But not every aircraft got in there because I had to get a transfer to another airport called Stansted. And they said, we're filled with aircraft which have diverted from other UK airports. So it's a fairly serious matter, crosswinds and high winds.
Now, there are different kinds of weather impacts. I mean,
sure.
Starting at the ground where you can have aircraft iced up and then
moving
up. I presume when you're close to land, there are different kind of weather problems than there might be high up.
There are indeed. The first one, you're quite right. Airframe icing was a serious problem, which came to fruition to some extent about 1982. You might remember Air Florida 90. A lot of video about it. It took off having been badly iced up from Washington International, Washington State as it was then. It's now Ronald Reagan Airport. And it crashed into the bridge, killing 4 people. It never really got airborne, went 300 feet, and it ploughed into
the ice. Was it just too heavy?
It was too heavy, and the wings weren't properly de-iced because the pilots were not experienced enough, and they had not put on anti-icing equipment on the aircraft. They had made a mistake going out, and it ploughed into the ice. But the video shows people who are floating up on the top, and they're sitting on ice, and helicopters come in and land them.
Yeah.
After that, new rules came out saying you must be de-iced 30 minutes before you line up on the runway.
And then you have those instruments, the pitot tubes,
which
could get clogged up
and they were. And they give you false readings, so you think you're going to take off and the speed isn't quite right, all that kind of thing. So icing and winter conditions have to be treated with great deal of care, not just in places where snow is common.
Now, as we move up, and you gave an example there of coming into land, takeoff is probably not as hazardous through stormy conditions because you're about to get airborne and you'll get lift, so off you
exactly.
go.
Exactly. Now, the problem there is, of course, crosswind components. You have to be careful. If you read the manuals of some of these aircraft, it says this has been demonstrated to, say, 25 knots or 35 knots crosswind. It's up to you as the captain to go further. So if it's a 40-knot crosswind, you can have a go at it, but you might not succeed. So they tell you that, and it's up to the captain to do that. But taking off, you keep the nose down, you keep the speed a little bit higher than normal, you pull back gently and she'll take off because the wind is pushing her hard on the wings. It wants to lift.
Now, let's talk about rain and temperature. First of all, I presume the lower down you are, the more difficult the rain is. You're not going to get rain at 30,000 feet.
That's true. Rain is a serious problem in tropical conditions. It can happen here, though, because if there's too much rain, you can actually get a thing called flameout. It's not usual, though, but it has happened in certain tropical conditions. Hong Kong, for example, and parts of India and parts of Africa. And that's why you have wipers on aircraft, because you can come in and land on it, you know, and that's why you must have visibility for the last few hundred feet of the aircraft.
So the pilot is in charge for those
Very
last...
Very much so, yeah. Mostly the pilots will use the autopilot to get them close to the ground, and then on the final approach their own skills come in. Yeah. Some aircraft are fully automatic and can land on the ground, but you need special equipment for that. But you need the skilled people up the front in most cases.
Now, what about high temperatures where the air might be thin as a result?
That can happen. People have made a mistake by working out how long do we need of a runway to take off, maybe, you know, so many 100 metres and that kind of thing. The higher you go and the hotter it gets, the thinner the air is. So you have to be moving at a particular speed to get the lift off. When you think about it, it's an aerofoil section like that. So high and hot, like Denver, for example, which is at 6,000 feet, or where I was down in Addis Ababa, that's about 6,000 feet as well. So you have to put in special measures. You have to be very certain that you've got the length of runway and that you've got the right temperatures, settings on the engines and all that kind of thing.
And it also demonstrates why at high altitude you can't get choppers in to rescue people off Everest.
Exactly.
There's no lift.
And in fact, there's a lot of videos still on YouTube now where a person tries to be rescued and the helicopter rotor blades rotate, but they don't go anywhere. And while the aircraft can land, it simply can't take off again. And it's a serious problem.
I remember years ago there was a big thing about wind shear.
Yes.
Now, explain wind shear.
Wind shear is really, it took a while to find out a number of accidents, principally in the USA, to do studies on it, and they've no equipment that will detect wind shear. Wind shear is basically wind columns, if you want to call them, rising or falling, up and down, but they're not predictable on the approach pad, for example, to an airport or anywhere surrounding the airport for that matter. And if you're coming into land and suddenly the wind drops away, you'll find yourself going too fast and you might actually be too low on the approach path. On the other hand, if there's too much wind, you know, lifting and you're into an updraft, you have to put the nose down and reduce the power. So it's very hard work for the last 5 miles of the approach. Aircraft have been literally plunged into the ground short of the runway and causing fatal accidents in America. But most airports which have this particular effect have equipment which can detect that now, and they can then forecast to the pilots, please don't approach yet.
Now let's go back up and the things you might encounter at high altitude. Lightning?
Lightning. In fact, aircraft are wired to prevent lightning damage to the aircraft. I was on a Gulfstream 4, which is the government jet at the time, leaving Brussels Airport, and we were through 4,000 or 5,000 feet in a storm, and there was a fantastic big bang and a blue flash. And what it was a lightning strike, which shocked everybody, you know, a bit of a bang. But the pilot said, "You're okay, the instruments are running perfectly well, and we can't see any damage." So we flew back to Baldonnell.
And did you see the lightning rolling along the...
No, luckily enough, there was just a single strike, but we...
Sometimes you see that as a passenger, instead of the trolley, you see lightning rolling down the corridor.
That's a discharge down the middle. St. Elmo's fire is the technical term for that. Apparently it's harmless, but I wouldn't get in its way if I could. But we were pleased to say there was no damage obvious in aircraft. So aircraft fly through the air. It's a fluid and it's got all these dynamic things around it. So it's wired so that lightning doesn't affect it. Having said that, we also looked at a King Air, which was a propeller-driven aircraft by the Air Corps, which had been struck twice by lightning, and it had taken a chunk off one of the propellers and it had fused part of the flaps of the back, so it can do damage even though the wiring is quite good.
Now finally, the other things up there, volcanic ash fallout, the smoke from forest fires can reduce visibility but also possibly do damage to the engines.
It can indeed. That was pointed out when the large volcano in Iceland, you might remember, it was literally stripping some of the coating on the blades which were, you know, spinning in the engine. So from then on, people were very cautious about flying through predicted ash fallout if the wind was going in a certain direction. It also happened over the Pacific where a 747 of British Airways had all four engines stopped by flying through invisible ash from a particular volcano. And luckily, having gone through 10,000 feet of the descent with no engines, the biggest glider in the world, they got one of the engines started and then they were able to restart the other three. And
did they tell the passengers?
Oh, they did. They did. They said, I mean, in the middle of the Pacific, it's a brace for landing, but you're in the middle of an ocean. What do you do?
And what about sandstorms over the Sahara or whatever? Would they ever go high enough?
They can indeed, depending on where you are. So pilots have radars in the nose of the aircraft, and these are not for finding out other aircraft positions. They're for predicting, in this case, clouds, heavy clouds with rain in them. You avoid them at all costs. But it can also pick up sandstorms if they're in the area, and you don't come into land through a sandstorm if at all possible, because you could be damaged in ways you don't even know.
Your message, though, to everyone is, by and large, it's safe.
Safest thing in the world, Pat.
Great stuff. Kevin, thank you very much. Kevin Byrne, retired Lieutenant Colonel and Airport and Safety and Security Expert.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.